Welcome to the official podcast of The Hoffeld Group. Your host is the CEO and Chief Sales Trainer of The Hoffeld Group, David Hoffeld.
Welcome to the official podcast of The Hoffeld Group, where we provide you with powerful sales insights that are based upon proven science and will help you sell more. I'm your host, the CEO and Chief Sales Trainer at The Hoffeld Group, David Hoffeld.
And today we have a very special guest, Ron Friedman. Ron is an award-winning social psychologist who specializes in human motivation. He has served on the faculty of various universities and colleges and has consulted for some of the world's most successful organizations. His research has appeared on NPR, in major newspapers including the New York Times, Financial Times, Washington Post, as well as magazines such as Men's Health, Entrepreneur, and Success. And he is the author of the highly acclaimed book, The Best Place to Work, The Art and Science of Creating an Extraordinary Workplace. He's also a frequent contributor to Harvard Business Review, Psychology Today, Fast Company, Forbes, and CNN. Ron, it's great to have you join us today.
Thanks for having me, David.
My first question for you perhaps is a little strange, but I want to ask it because you are a social psychologist. What inspired you to write a book about the modern workplace?
Well, you know what? It stems from my experience of being in the modern workplace. So I spent years being a social psychologist, teaching at colleges and universities, studying motivation in the lab. And then I decided, you know what? The reason I got into academics is because I like learning new things. And as a professor, you end up just teaching the same thing again and again. So you're not really learning very much once you get into that full-time position. So I decided I'm going to go off into the corporate world. And I became a pollster. So my job was to measure public opinion and to tell businesses and organizations what people think of them and what they need to say in order to sell. And I love the job. I really enjoyed it. But one of the most striking things that I realized while being in that position is that there is a massive divide between how businesses operate and what science tells us are the ways that we get people motivated and creative and engaged. And so I turned my attention to writing a book that takes over 1,000 academic studies and translates them into plain English so that regardless of whether you're a CEO or just someone who's entering the workplace, there's something in it for you on how you can apply the latest research to elevating your performance at work.
Yeah, and I want to talk about some of the ideas that you have in your book, The Best Place to Work, which I'd highly recommend because, as Ron just mentioned, it is based, grounded in over 1,000 academic studies, so there's that research basis, so it's a reliable guide. But one of the things that really jumped out to me, Ron, in your book was you share numerous examples and research that suggests that many of us may need to rethink how we view failure. So can you share with us how we often view failure in unproductive ways and what a more empowering approach might be?
Yeah, well, you know, when we think about success or failure, we see them as black or white. But in fact, if you're trying to be successful over the long run, you're going to need to take some risks. We don't learn by doing the same thing again and again. We learn by taking intelligent risks and then utilizing the feedback we get to improve our performance the next time. So I'll give you an example of this from my own life. I have a toddler at home named Henry, and Henry recently learned how to walk. And if you have kids at home, then you know this is a fascinating thing to watch up close, is how children learn to walk. They don't learn to walk by sitting around and observing and then one day standing and saying, ta-da, I'm ready to take my first step. It's by first accepting the fact that every once in a while they're going to stumble or they're going to fall and slip back down on their diaper, and the world won't end. And accepting failure, accepting the fact that they're not always going to be successful, is what enables them to learn. And the same is true for all of us. Unless we're willing to take that first step, we're just not going to be successful. And in fact, if you look at the people who are at the top of their game, they end up failing more often than everyone else. And it's because they have so many successes that we forget about the failures. And it's everyone from people like Thomas Edison, who we all know we've all heard stories about all of his failures, to athletes, famous athletes like Babe Ruth. Babe Ruth, we all know, was a fantastic player. He also happened to have the most career strikeouts. Kobe Bryant had more career missed shots than any other basketball player. Brett Favre, most interceptions. And it also goes to companies. So companies like Apple fail all the time. You know, we often associate the iPhone with Steve Jobs, but we forget that Steve Jobs failed with Apple One, Apple Two, Lisa, and Google. Google fails all the time. They failed with Google Wave. They failed with Google Buzz. Google Plus, what some people are saying, is about to disappear. So, you know, there are all of these things that these organizations are doing in terms of making risks possible. And so in The Best Place to Work, I talk about the importance of encouraging and rewarding smart failure. We're not talking about reward all failures. We're not talking about like failures that are caused by lack of effort or lack of attention to detail. We're talking about intelligent risk-taking. And unless you have a system for rewarding people for taking risks, you're going to see creativity and innovation and productivity really grind to a halt.
What a powerful takeaway that I think I would encourage our listeners to think through that, because I think understanding that failure is part of success and failing smartly, as you mentioned and you write about so well in your book, is an important component of success, and it's hard to become successful without having failures. So understand they're a necessary step on the ladder of success. But Ron, you mentioned the idea of creativity and how to foster that, and that was one thing that really jumped out from your book. In fact, you write about that, and I remember when I read a certain phrase, which I'll share with our listeners here, in the book, I stopped, and I read it again, and then I highlighted it, and then I wrote some things next to it. I mean, it was a powerful idea that I think really unlocks the idea of creativity in a very powerful way. So let me share that quote. You write in your book, "What we create is a function of the information we consume." Can you explain this idea and share with our listeners how they can apply it to become more creative?
Well, creativity has much less to do with your genetic makeup than it does with the ideas that you're exposed to. So most of us very rarely think very deliberately about the information that we take in. But our ideas are determined by the things we pay attention to. So it's everything from the shows you watch to the music you listen to, the podcasts you take in, the books you read. All of them are influencing the way you think. They're the kind of like the raw material that combine to form your ideas. And when you look at some of the more creative innovations in history, that's exactly what you see, is you see ideas combining. So, for example, Steve Jobs, we just talked about Steve Jobs and Apple. He didn't invent the MP3 player. He didn't invent the cell phone, but he found a way of combining them, and that creative combination resulted in the iPhone. And he's certainly not the only person who came up with creative ideas by combining two pre-existing ideas in a new way. Back in 1995, two Stanford students took the idea of a search engine, and they combined it with the way that academics cite research articles. And today, that combination is Google. And so there's this great you enjoyed the quote on what we create as a function of the information we consume. Well, I'm going to give you another quote that you might like even better. And it's from a writer named Matt Ridley, who has written that creativity is what happens when ideas have sex. And so once you recognize that creativity is not something that appears out of thin air, it's not a genetic gift, the formula for increasing your creativity becomes simple, and that's simply find more interesting ideas.
And what a fascinating way to rethink creativity, rather than it's just this innate gift we often ascribe to it, but it's really not a matter so much of what comes out of us, but really what we put into us, and really connecting the dots with that. That's a fascinating way for any of us to become more creative, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, I give talks on creativity all the time for organizations, and one of the things I tell people is that when you have an idea, when you have a project that requires a new idea, rather than forcing yourself to come up with something on the spot, is hold on to that notion of what it is you're trying to the puzzle you're trying to crack, and then go on a creativity diet. Shift the information you're consuming, tweak it just a little bit. So if you listen to country music, start listening to techno music, or vice versa. Or if you are if you consistently watch reality television, start watching PBS. If you are reading fiction, start reading nonfiction. If you twist it up just a little bit, what you'll find is all of a sudden that problem you're trying to solve, you have a completely new perspective on it.
again, another extremely powerful takeaway, because all of us want to be more creative in business and be more innovative. How do you do that? Ron just gives, right there and also in his book, a recipe for creativity. But, Ron, I want to maybe switch gears a little bit, because we have a lot of our listeners who are business leaders, sales leaders, and one of the things you write about in your book is how highly effective leaders don't force solutions on people, but rather they guide them in discovering solutions on their own, and then they own them. So can you give our listeners really some practical ways that they can help guide others in identifying solutions rather than just feeding them answers?
Well, first let me just highlight why that's so critical, and it's because we have these basic human psychological needs, and if we don't have those needs fulfilled, we simply can't be at our most energized, we're not going to be at our most engaged. So if you look at what is it that makes organizations successful, what is it that people want from their job, the science tells us is that they want psychologically fulfilling experiences. So what makes for a psychologically fulfilling experience? Well, it's a few things. One is feeling like you're competent, so feeling like you're good at your job and having the ability to grow your competence on a regular basis. The second need is the need for connections, human connections, feeling related, feeling respected, appreciated, valued, all the great things that come from being around other people. That's another vital component. But the third one, which plays into the question you just asked, which is why is it so important that we invite people to come up with solutions rather than telling them what we want them to do, is the need for autonomy. So feeling like you have some say in how you go about doing your job. You're not simply being micromanaged. You're not simply being, you're not following instructions. You're doing the work you're doing because you want to be doing it. And when we have that experience of autonomy, we tend to be happier, healthier, and more productive at work. And this is the mistake that a lot of managers make, is they think, I'm going to bring someone in and I'm going to tell them how to go do their job, and that's the thing that's going to make them successful, because they're following my instructions. But in fact, if you're just following someone else's instructions, then you don't have that opportunity to be fully engaged, because you're not part of the solution. So a better approach from a managerial perspective, from a leadership perspective, is when you introduce a new project, invite the members of your team to be part of that process. So identify what the outcome is you're looking for, but then invite the people on your team to co-create the process. So you highlight the outcome, and you invite them to co-create the process. And the way you do that is by asking them some very intelligent and sort of leading questions, where you say, here's what we're trying to achieve. What solutions do you see for this? And then guide the discussion along the way. You know, we're at our most persuasive, influential, and motivating when we're listening. It's not when we're telling other people what to do. It's when we're listening. So if you can be an effective listener, chances are you're well on your way to being an effective leader.
A lot of organizations, one of their biggest struggling points is finding the right people to bring on their team, finding the right people to have around them. And you talk about so well, and we do a lot of research on this too from a sales perspective, on some of these hiring biases, these biases that often cloud our judgments when making hiring decisions, because even the best managers report that there's an alarming amount of poor hires that they make that they later regret. So can you maybe share with our listeners a few of these most common biases that really hinder our ability to identify the right candidate for an open position? And then also, if you wouldn't mind sharing, what can be done to really limit these interviewing blind spots?
Well, so how do we hire at most organizations? We have in-person interviews. That's how the vast majority of organizations hire these days. So we have, we'll put up an ad, and then we'll have maybe someone screen the responses, and then we'll bring someone in, and we'll have them interview with five different people, and then we'll bring them in again, and we'll do it again. We'll do it three different times. We assume that just more exposure to the person is what we need. But in fact, in-person interviews are a disastrous tool for evaluating a job candidate, and it's for a number of reasons. For one thing, research tells us that over 80% of job candidates are going to lie during a job interview, and that's on the basis of asking them 10 questions. So if you ask them more than 10 questions, the percentages are probably going to go up. 81% are going to lie to you on some level. But even if you did get 100% honest responses, you still wouldn't be necessarily identifying the best people, and it's because of all of the biases that you just mentioned that come about because of the way our brains function. So we automatically make all of these erroneous assumptions about a candidate from their appearance. So it's the first thing we judge them on is what do they look like? good-looking people tend to be viewed as more competent. Why? Because we assume that if they are good-looking, that other things are going well in their life because of a halo effect. Tall candidates are viewed as having more leadership potential than they actually do. So we tend to overvalue the leadership potential of someone who's tall. Deep-voiced candidates are viewed as being more trustworthy than they actually are. And all of these things are not necessarily true, but they affect the questions that we ask over the course of the interview. So, for example, if I assume, David, that you're extroverted, I might ask you a question along the lines of, tell me about a time you led a group. But if, for whatever reason, I've gotten the impression that you're introverted, I might ask a slightly different question. I might say, are you comfortable in front of large groups? And both of those questions get at the same fundamental construct, but because they're worded differently, your response is going to confirm my initial assumption. And so it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And so one of the solutions I argue for in the book is, rather than bringing people in for all of these interviews, is start off by creating a job-relevant task. In other words, give them a job audition. Give them something they're going to actually be doing when they're working for you. Have them do that thing. You may need to pay people a little bit of money to get them to do this, but it's a worthwhile investment, because now you can have your screener screen people by their performance on that initial task, and then that your first impression is how they did the task you asked them to do. So, for example, if you're hiring a salesperson, you might want to have them write you a sales letter or have them pitch you and then read the transcript. If you're hiring a receptionist, you might want to bring her in for an afternoon and have her answer your phones. If you're hiring a web designer, you can have her create a landing page. And then in all of these cases, you want to evaluate them by their work product first and only then conduct your job interview. And in fact, you know, I'm hiring right now in my organization, and this is exactly the process we're following. And we're being very careful about this. It's going to take a little bit more time and a little bit more money, but we're confident we're going to make a better decision.
Those are very, very important points that I want to highlight for our listeners, because hiring the right people is the easiest way to set yourself up and your organization for success. And asking people to demonstrate competence and really minimize the effects of a lot of these cognitive biases that we all have, because as Ron mentioned, how our brains are wired, that often mislead us and cause us to make poor hiring decisions, is such an important piece. And the ROI on this is through the roof, as Ron mentioned. Any minimal cost in hiring rightly is in comparison to a poor hire, there is no comparison. So this is such an important piece for all organizations. Ron, I want to ask you maybe a little unusual question as our time here concludes, and that is, you know, with your research, and you know, you do a lot of consulting with a lot of leading organizations and also your basis in science, I wanted to see, when you think about what the workplace will look like in the future, if you were to project, let's say, 5-10 years, let's say, in the future, what do you think it'll be like? How will the workplace then be different than today?
Well, you know, there's so much that I can sort of prognosticate based on the trends we're seeing so far, but I'll just focus on three points. One is, I think we're going to get a lot more careful about applying some of the science and figuring out, using analytics, how well our workplace is performing. There is a vast appetite now for using data-driven insights, and we can start applying that methodology by keeping our fingers on the pulse of whether or not people are feeling engaged and what are the factors that are contributing or undermining that engagement. I think you're going to see a lot more careful analysis of that on a regular basis, not simply in the year-end engagement survey that organizations are doing right now. So that's number one. The other thing I think is going to happen is, I think you're going to see a lot more organizations encouraging their people to disconnect, paying people to turn off their computers and silencing their phones. The iPhone, we tend to forget, is only 8 years old. It's really a baby technology, and it's designed to make everything feel urgent. We're all carrying around an office with us in our pocket, and that tends to undermine our engagement. It doesn't improve our engagement. If you're working around the clock, if you're answering your emails at night, if you're working over the weekend, a year from now, your engagement is going to take a hit, and it's because you're going to get burnt out. And so we see all of these great examples of organizations that are paying people to turn off their email and to actually disconnect after work hours. So, for example, BMW has a server that they turn down at the end of the shift in the evening so that you can write people an email 10 o'clock at night, but it's not going to get in their inbox until 7:30 the next morning. It's a way of encouraging people to enjoy their time with their family. It's going to make them better at their jobs, not worse. And the final thing I would say is I think we're going to get a lot smarter at calibrating the tasks that we do at work to the amount of energy that we have. So once upon a time, you know, you'd go into a factory and you'd stand on the operating line, and your productivity was a function of how many hours you spent at work. That's no longer the case. Our work now is directly connected to the quality of the energy that we bring to it. And so we now know that if you're looking to do some planning or if you're making important decisions, you want to do that when you have high levels of energy. But if you're trying to be creative, you don't want to do that during high levels of energy. You want to do that during low periods of energy, because when you are very mentally sharp, you tend to dismiss seemingly irrelevant ideas. But often it's the connections between what you're thinking about now and a seemingly irrelevant idea that leads to a creative insight. And so that's why you see people being more creative in the evenings when they're tired, after they've taken a shower, after they've had a cocktail. That's when creativity happens. And so I think we can improve our productivity vastly by getting smarter at when we do the work, not just how much we work, but when we work. And I think we're going to get better at that.
Fascinating. Well, Ron, you have given our listeners so many practical, thought-provoking ideas here today. If they do want to learn more about you and the resources that you and your organization provide, where can they go?
Well, there are two spots. One is the best place to work. book.com, and that's the book website, and you can download the opening chapter of the book for free. And the other is Ignite 80, which is the name of my company. And the reason it's called Ignite 80 is because over 80% of employees are not fully engaged at work, according to the latest data. The mission of Ignite 80 is to reverse that trend by teaching leaders practical things they can do to improve their organizations. So it's ignite80.com.
Excellent. And I would highly recommend Ron's book, The Best Place to Work, and you definitely want to check out his website as well. Ron, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you, David.
Well, once again, special thanks to our guest, Ron Friedman, for sharing some fascinating and very actionable insights with us. And join us here next time on the Huffell Group podcast. And remember, selling is just too important to be based on anything other than proven science. We'll see you next time.